ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land, green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm one of your hosts. My name's Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here in Oshkosh. Right across the table from me is my good friend Hal.
And I'm Hal Bryan, EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications at EAA.
And Hal, always love episodes where we get to talk to someone really cool. Most yes. episodes are like that, I feel. But today, a special guest is Ronak DeVay. Someone who works in mission control at NASA. Ronak, thank you for being here.
Of course. Thank you guys so much for having me.
Well, so Ronak, what is your official title in mission control? What do you do?
So my official title is flight director here at the Johnson Space Center. And so at the Johnson Space Center, home of astronaut training, human space flight, we have the mission control center, and we are leading the teams working on the International Space Station, on our Artemis missions, and a plethora of other missions that help support our human spaceflight enterprise.
Wow. Now, you know, when I think mission control, I'm guilty of thinking right away of like Apollo 13 and, you know, Ed Harris playing Gene Kranz and you know, but is it anything like that for people that are listening who maybe have never been there, but that's all they know of? You know, do you get a little bit of sense of like, yeah, that's kind of what it was like, but yet I'm sure by today's standards, a lot different.
Yeah, funny enough, when people ask what a flight director do, the easiest reference in the media out there, right, is Ed Harris playing Gene Kranz in Apollo 13, and I've had the good luck of meeting Gene in real life a few times, and it is similar and different, like you mentioned, right? We can't really smoke anymore in the control center, so that's a big one. Computers have gotten a little more advanced, but the foundations of what we do and how we operate as a team really were built by those teams back in the late 50s, early 60s. Chris Kraft, Gene Kranz, many other pioneers along the way that helped build the foundations and, in many senses, framework for how we operate as a team today.
Wow. I always thought it was interesting that the building is named after Chris Kraft, which is great, you know, the godfather of mission control, but that his full name was Christopher Columbus Kraft. Like, what a great name for someone who's going to lead space exploration.
Name.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Says Chris Magellan Henry.
Yes, right? Yeah, exactly.
So Ronak, I'm curious about your background. What was your path? How did you find your way to NASA and into the role as a flight director?
Yeah. So obviously aviation and spaceflight and just technology in that sense was something that really fascinated me from a young age. I mean, you could probably go talk to my mom and ask her the amount of appliances that were maybe not that broken that I ended up breaking after taking them apart and trying to put them back together. I grew up in the Northeast in New Jersey, and I think flight probably had a good piece of that, right? I kind of lived in the center intersection of Teterboro Airport, JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia. So I was constantly on someone's landing approach and seeing planes overhead. And that kind of bore its way to rockets and how these enormous things were able to fly and take flight. And so that kind of was always a part of me. And that, I think, helped build kind of an engineer's mindset of, well, how do these things work and how do they break and how do I fix them if they break? Which led me to actually finding Chris Kraft's book in grade school. And it was one of those remarkable moments where you kind of read about the history of spaceflight and the challenges those teams had. And immediately I started to see myself in those shoes of, oh, well, this kind of lines up with the things I'm good at. So that took me on a journey out to Indiana, where I went to college at Purdue University, which has a pretty deep and rich history with NASA. The first and most recent astronauts to walk on the moon went there, and along with hundreds, if not thousands, of other graduates that work at different nooks and crannies of NASA and even aerospace today. While I was there, I was lucky enough to get a Pathways internship opportunity. At that point, it was called the co-op program here with the Johnson Space Center. So while I was in school there, every other semester, I'd be down here working with the teams or a team and then go back to school, and then was lucky enough to be offered a full-time opportunity after that. that started out in the ISS guidance, navigation, control, flight control discipline. So I worked as a call sign ADCO, attitude determination control officer, for a bunch of years, flying the International Space Station, making sure we're pointed the right direction, and getting out of the way of stuff that we don't want to hit us. That parlayed itself into a propulsion officer, where I worked as a propulsion officer on the first two Boeing test flights for the CST-100 Starliner, was working on development of the Orion vehicle and the Space Launch System that we're going to use to fly back to the moon. Got selected right before that first flight of Artemis 1 a few years ago. And that brought me here to the flight director office, which was a humbling place to be, right? It's a job where you can't be upset if you never get, and it was incredible to have gotten selected. You mentioned Gene Kranz, right? There's been 108 flight directors since the first flight director, Chris Kraft. So it's a pretty limited and amazing company to keep.
Wow. Yeah, that is some amazing company that you're in. Ronak, this is probably a very unfair question, but is there such a thing as sort of a typical day in the life of a flight director? I'm kind of assuming there isn't, but would love to have you talk through. You know, you show up for your work day, your shift, and how does it go?
Yeah, there really isn't a typical day. I'll give you a couple of days, right? So there's in the office where, like today, I've been working on some development, right? Working on some lessons learned from missions we've flown, working on paperwork, if you will, but building those products for future missions coming up, working with the teams. A big part of our job is also training, right? So I had a few flight controllers here in my office today where we talked about a simulation that we all took part in last week and how we thought we did, what we could do better, doing that debrief face-to-face and working on those skills. I'm going to come see you guys here this weekend, spoiling the date for the podcast here, but for your space day, and then I'll quick trip back here to Houston where I'm going to be on console Monday and Tuesday. So coming into console, working what we call the Orbit 3 shift, which is traditionally what, the second shift for most industries. So I'd come in around 3 o'clock and that's usually actually when the crew is asleep. So we run the ISS on GMT, Greenwich Mean Time. So we'll have put the astronauts to bed at the end of the working day here in Houston. And then my job is to plan the rest of the day for tomorrow, make sure we've got a clean plan on board. And then we're looking at plan reviews for the week out, the next 3 days out, and making sure that we're setting ourselves up for success later in the week. It's kind of like your pre-flight, if you will, right? The time on board is really expensive. And obviously it's a limited resource. So we do our best to set everyone else up, the ground teams and the crew, for success as the days come up.
Wow. That is a day. How long is a normal shift for you guys?
It's about 9 hours, and that gives you an hour on each side for handover to your shift and off of your shift.
Wow. And it's, I would assume that it's, of course, you're monitoring it 24/7, right?
Yeah, that's right. So ISS operations are quiescent. So we've got some amount of a team on 24/7, 365. As the ISS has grown and we've learned more how to fly her, we've been able to, in some of those weekend night type shifts where the crew is off or asleep, we can pare it down to kind of a skeleton crew, just making sure we keep the ship flying and could respond to any off-nominal situations, and obviously have the ability to call other people in if we need their support.
You mentioned that, you know, one of those responsibilities, talking about flying the ISS and, you know, keeping it out of the way if there is some threat of an obstacle or something. Can you talk us through, even if it's just sort of a broad hypothetical scenario, of how that would work? Like when do you discover there might be a conflict, and then what are the steps? What are the actions you take?
Yeah. So fortunately and unfortunately, we can't really predict the time all the time, but that's part of the problem. So, I mean, as you guys know, space debris is a growing problem, for lack of a word, and something we deal with every day. And we have a console position in the control center, the trajectory operations and planning officer, and they have pretty tight connections with the Space Force and the monitoring wings there that catalog all those objects. So there's some analysis that happens there, and if we're in a position where a piece of space debris is on a trajectory where it could lead to a conjunction with the space station, we kind of have some parameters of pizza boxes and volumes around the space station that we go do a bunch of math on. And if that math determines that the likelihood is high enough probability, then we put together a translational maneuver and change our altitude and get out of the way of that object.
You mentioned pizza boxes. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah. So obviously the ISS, if you have seen a picture, is kind of an odd shape, right? So we expand the bounds of that to provide just a volume to genericize the shape to help us do the probability math around.
Ah, gotcha. So that's just sort of a colloquialism for, if I'm understanding correctly, we're sort of drawing a big imaginary rectangle around the ISS and saying,
yeah, exactly,
and saying that's the shape that we're going to keep free of.
Right. It's the volume conjunction we want to protect.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, wow, that's really something. How big does an object of space debris have to be before it's a serious concern and requires a maneuver to get out of the way?
Yeah. So I'll answer that a different way. Basically any, right? When you're talking about the International Space Station's flying at 17,500 miles an hour. So when you're talking about orbital velocities, anything moving that quickly imparts an enormous amount of energy. So the sizes are almost irrelevant, if that makes sense.
Wow. So basically, if it's something that Space Command and the other groups that are tracking, you know, if they know about it, then it's enough to be a concern.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, just curious, from the time that you are sort of alerted that there might be something there to the time that you're actually able to move the space station, like how much lead time does that take to get everybody together to move that?
Yeah, we've gotten pretty good at it, again, for better or worse. So we have some predetermined debris avoidance maneuver timelines that we kind of have canned products for, and that's on the order of a few hours. There's obviously, if we get inside of that, there's other actions we can take. But at that point, it's preservation of your escape vehicle and making sure we can keep the crew safe, and less about the ISS at that point.
Wow. So let's back up for just a minute. You know, you as you were going through your program and then getting into, going through college and getting in there, I always like to ask people, how does it feel the first time you get that letter that says NASA at the top and it says that you're going to go work there? That has to be an amazing feeling.
Oh, it was surreal. I actually remember the explicit moment. It was a phone call, and I was in a German 101 class in college. And I just, in the midst of taking a quiz, I believe, I just walked out of the room because I saw the Houston area code, and I did not care about my performance on that German language quiz that day after I got done with that phone call. So yeah, there's a bunch of surreals, right? There's that. There's driving on site for the first time and seeing the signs, walking into the control center, and we've got these huge, thick metal, clunky doors, and clicking those open for the first time. Yeah, it's something you try not and forget, right? It's easy to get caught up in the machine of work and you forget why you're here. And I like every now and then when I'm sitting on an overnight or something to just look up at the boards and see the gorgeous views we're getting on these HD downlink cameras and remember why we do this.
Wow.
Oh, that's really something. I'm sure Von Braun would have been proud of you making the right choice there, you know, studying German or getting it out and taking that call.
Yeah, I probably a couple words I forgot that day out of my vocabulary, but I'm sure you'd be okay with that.
You know, do you get to build up a pretty good rapport or relationship or bond with the astronauts?
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of our job. When you consider the ISS, right, that from the letter of the law that the crew works for the ISS commander on board, and then they kind of work for the flight director in real time. And then we all kind of work for the program and the enterprise, but there's a really significant amount of trust that they put in us, that we're the eyes and ears on the ground, and we're making decisions on their behalf of things they may not have complete insight into, but we're always operating under the pretenses that their safety is paramount. Then the vehicle safety, and then we talk about mission objectives. So we definitely, they work next door to us in the building next door and run into them, training opportunities just in the hallways. I consider it a big and important part of our job to maintain that relationship.
Out of curiosity, sort of building on that a bit, does that, Does that extend to Roscosmos cosmonauts and also I'm also just sort of curious about how that sort of breakdown of responsibility and stuff works. Are you and your team as flight directors truly responsible for the entire station, or is there any sort of division of territory with the other with either Russia or the other nations involved?
Yeah. So I will answer the second half of that first, and then we'll get to the first half if that's okay.
That's perfect.
So if you consider the ISS as a bunch of partners, right, and some of those have vested interest in terms of modules. So we have a bunch of control centers we work with around the world. We've got the European Space Agency control center outside of Munich in Oberpfefferhofen, Germany. You've got the JAXA flight control team out in Scuba, Japan. And like you mentioned, we've got our Roscosmos, Russian Space Agency counterparts at Korolev outside of Moscow. There is a division of labor of who manages what, right? Everyone's kind of responsible for their modules. And then there's a lead flight director role. And we talk about rules, right? Flight rules was something that Chris Kraft kind of envisioned and really putting all these decisions that we can think about before we get into the heat of battle in paper. So there's rules that dictate who the lead flight control center is and lead flight director. And most of the time that's Houston. And if there's a complex activity going on the Russian segment, then the Moscow team will take over as a lead. But yeah, that division is really a part of that conversation. And at the end of the day, there's also just a conversation that happens, right? We're all trying to do the right thing. So we're going to make sure that the right thing happens. In terms of the cosmonauts, yeah. So I think more day to day, if I'm just a flight director on console and in the office and doing things, right, I'm going to maintain the relationships with who's around here. So the cosmonauts are not here as often. They're kind of here when they're assigned. So when you become a lead flight director for an expedition or an increment, which is kind of the 4 to 6 month chunks of time that we talk about as missions on the International Space Station or one of the visiting vehicles that are taking a crew to the station, you are definitely forming a far deeper connection with the crew assigned to that if you're the lead and you are you're really kind of their greatest advocate on the ground in that case, where all of us are generically, if I'm just working console, but as a lead, you take a little bit more responsibility.
Wow. That is incredible. I got to tell you, as we're talking, all I keep thinking about is like all the movies I've seen of Mission Control. So I have so many more questions that you're probably like, oh my God, these guys are really nerding out. But that's why we're here. So
exactly.
Yeah, happy to talk about it.
Is there any kind of delay when you're talking to the space station, or is it pretty straightforward?
Station is pretty seamless. There's probably a couple seconds, but not enough to be noticeable. I know we've talked about in the past, and I think we've tried it out once or twice of going to lunar or Martian delays kind of as a tech demo to see how the teams would be able to operate. That was a couple of years ago. We haven't done it since then, but it's something that we have in our toolbox that we can use to help train everybody as to how lunar ops or Martian ops would end up being.
How long is a lunar delay? Like if your spacecraft is up heading to the moon, what kind of delay are you talking?
Yeah, it's when you get out to the moon. It's on the tens of seconds. It's enough to be noticeable when you're trying to have a back and forth conversation.
And then how about with Mars looking ahead? I just love hearing these terms sort of in an everyday way, like Martian operations and things. It just, that's something we've been waiting for and looking forward to for so long. So it's so exciting just to hear that that's even part of the day-to-day nomenclature. But anyway, what's that delay going to be like when we get there?
Yeah, that's on the order of minutes, right? So like and hours in some cases. So you get to the point where you really can't have back and forth conversations. And that is something we've thought about in how we would train crews and what products we'd provide as references, right? You kind of have to do things on your own. And so the analogy I like to use is if you think about human spaceflight as camping, the International Space Station, now that it's fully built and operational, and it's kind of like camping in your backyard where you're close to home. Yeah, you have all the things you need. And if you really get in trouble, you can come home pretty quickly. And if you don't want to come home, you can walkie-talkie into the house and mom and dad will or bring you out some waters, right? When you get to lunar operations and lunar surface operations, it's more like going camping in the state park where you're still a couple days, couple hours from home. You're bringing what you need, but you don't have everything you'd want. And it's not as easy to get something if you forget it or if you need something special. When you talk about Mars, it's like going backpacking in Yosemite and you have no help, right? So we're really using each of these building blocks to help generate capabilities and learning and using those lessons learned to move us to the next checkpoint and then learn from that and then build that whole base of knowledge to take you to what really becomes a multi-year mission to bring crews there and back to Mars.
Wow. Wow. I can't wait for that day. And I know we're all excited to see that in our lifetimes.
Yeah, I think we all are.
Do you have a mission that you're most proud of that you have worked on?
Oh, that's hard. So I'm staring at a couple of plaques. So a cool thing we do in the control center, I'm not sure if you guys know about this tradition, but if you look in the control center photos, you'll see the walls lined with plaques. So for each mission we fly, the lead flight director for that mission will pick a team member, basically an MVP, and then a deputy MVP to hold the ladder and hang the plaque. And that's kind of the highest honor of the mission. But we end up getting a bunch of those plaques. And for the rest of the team that supported that mission, they usually get kind of a plaque handed to them just to keep in their office to remember they worked the mission. So I have a bunch of them just on my wall here. And then as flight directors, something we started doing in the offices here is for missions you're leads for, you'll put them outside your door. So if you walk up and down the halls, you'll know what missions folks have worked from just looking at their door. But I'd say that I'm not sure I have a favorite. They all have their unique challenges and learning experiences. And I think that's just a part of it. So SpaceX 30, which was a cargo mission last year, earlier this year, was my first lead assignment as a flight director. So just that being my first was a really exciting thing to go build that team and execute that mission and get the payloads we brought up there, experiments and all the science back home safe. Back as a flight controller, like I mentioned, I worked those first two Boeing Starliner test flights, and those were really challenging, but I think really rewarding as a flight controller to really go through the heat of a mission that didn't really go as we expected it to, and to be able to salvage whatever we could out of it and bring both those capsules home safe. So I think those are a couple of examples.
Wow. Running, I don't want to get at all personal, so feel free just to pass on answering this, but I'm curious if you have any particular, like you mentioned the plaques and where they hang, which is really cool. Do you have any sort of personal traditions or even like a good luck charm or something? I mean, we all know, you know, Gene, of course, being famous for his white vest. Is there any little thing that you bring with you or that you do or you always have on hand when you're working?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think I do. Yeah, no, I don't think I do. I think it's maybe more than like a physical totem or token. It's a little bit of the mindset too, where something I've always thought about, even as a flight controller, is when you go into that room, obviously you have a personality and you work differently. And I'm sure folks will probably point this out about me if they know me personally, right? I'm kind of a different person in the flight control room. And part of it is you kind of take on the persona is the wrong word, right? But you become the console more than you are the individual, and just kind of sitting in the parking lot before I walk in and taking the deep breath and walking in and doing that. Maybe that's the closest I can give you.
That's great. Cause that's not a position where you can, you know, slide in 10 or 15 minutes late and just, and sort of, you know, sit in the back of the room and say, you know, today's not going to be my best day, and get away with it. I mean, there's some jobs and some roles in life where you can have a kind of a down day here or there, but yours in particular is one of those that wouldn't be very forgiving of that.
Yeah. And I'd say that goes for not just the flight director, right, but everyone in that room. And I think it's been attributed to a bunch of people, but I'll say that the person I heard it from most recently on a separate podcast a few years ago was not our current chief of the flight director office, but the prior chief, Holly Ridings. And people always ask if you're scared or nervous or anxious going into the control center. And there's an interesting answer there that I agree with, where if you feel completely comfortable in that seat at any time, then you ought to go think about what you're doing, right? There's a healthy bit of anxiety that you need to make sure you're on edge in the good way and thinking sharply that is helpful to you, so long as you can keep it healthy. And if you become extremely comfortable and that can lead you to just being a little more loose and that can get away from you.
Wow.
That's actually just like good leadership advice too.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, would that we all, you know, could live our lives like that all the time, but at least to understand the importance of, as you said, everyone in your building and the role that they have to play. And I liked what you said very much about taking a minute in the parking lot and just making sure you're in the right mindset. That's gotta be crucial.
One of the questions I have is, you know, Mission Control is famous for, you know, seeing like the trenches, you know, the different levels of controllers, the different consoles. Is current Mission Control still, I know it's the same building, but different level. But does it still have that sort of trench layout? And what does some of those people do and how many people are generally on a shift?
Yeah. So unfortunately, I really love the stadium seating, but we got rid of the stadium seating that we used to have, in the trench, aptly named, was the lowest level of that stadium seating, which if you come to the Johnson Space Center, actually the flight control room where we landed Apollo 11 was deemed a National Historic Landmark. And a few years ago, Gene and the Space Center Houston Visitor Center raised a bunch of money to actually restore it back to the condition it was when we landed Apollo 11. So it's set up to where they can actually turn all the screens on and kind of plays you the landing sequence and lights the room up. But all the chairs, the ashtrays, the coat racks, everything was sourced back from stuff that was available and in that room in the 60s. So it's really cool to see it in that configuration. And to get back to the point, the trench was the lowest level where all your trajectory guys sat. So the moniker is still held by the trajectory teams here, but we kind of don't sit in the same configuration and the ISS room, nor the other Artemis room, which used to be the shuttle flight control room, the white Ficker. So Ficker 1, which is the ISS flight control room, is laid out a little bit differently and more to the purposes of a sustained spaceflight of a space station. So we don't have the trench, but the folks who worked in the trench from a technical standpoint definitely still like to call themselves that, even though they don't necessarily sit in the trench.
That's great.
Love it.
Hey, Ronak, what would you say when you talk to people about what you do, and you know, they're coming at it as we were saying at the beginning with this understanding from pop culture and Ed Harris makes a good sort of starting place, baseline example, but is there something that people find the most surprising when you sort of tell them, you know, what it's really like? I mean, aside from the fact that you're not chain smoking in front of a CRT anymore, but
so one of the, let me see if this answers your question. And it's just another example I like to use. So if you consider the room, we've got a bunch of people in there and all those people are experts in their discipline, right? Whether it's spacecraft, guidance, navigation, control, environmental systems, life support systems, power systems, everyone has their job. And at any moment in time at 3 a.m, they're going to be my foremost expert in the world in that topic. So the example you hear a lot of the times is that the flight director is kind of the conductor of the orchestra, right? I know what the sheet of music is. I don't know exactly how to play your instrument, but I have the sheet of music. I have a tempo and I know what it's supposed to sound like. And I know if everyone's in tune. I've kind of changed that paradigm a little bit for the International Space Station because that sheet of music changes constantly. And sometimes you have to change it quickly and change it in ways you didn't think. So it's more like I'm a band leader of a big band, jazz band, right? Where sometimes the music isn't exactly what you thought it'd be, but you're still making music. And as long as I'm making music at the end of the day and moving forward, then I'm doing the right thing.
That's a great analogy.
That is too cool. What was like maybe one of the biggest challenges you had to overcome on a mission? Was there something that you can speak to, you know, about, you know, your Apollo 13 moment, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. So I will give you an example. And this is actually from back when I was an intern. That really was, in my opinion, the closest to Apollo 13 I've gotten so far. So this was in 2012, 2013, probably. I'm looking around my room trying to see if I have something with the date on it, but I don't think I have it out anymore. But we were working to, we had failed an external power box. So basically think about your breaker box outside failing. So we had gone to do a spacewalk to go replace that breaker box. And when we went to install the new one, it just would not go into where we're supposed to. The bolt stanchions were binding and we just could not get it in. And mind you, this is a quarter of the power to the space station. So it's a pretty big deal to be down. So we brought the crew back inside from their spacewalk. They did their debrief, went to bed, and then we basically took that whole team over to the space vehicle mock-up facility and dumped all of our tools out on the table.
Wow.
Everything we had on the space station, said, all right, well, what can we do? Which felt very much like an Apollo 13 moment. So we ended up building a bolt stanchion cleaner with some 4-gauge wire that we had cut open and splayed open, covered in tape that we could put into the EVA drill to kind of clean the threads out. We then took a toothbrush, connected it to, I think it was a large depth socket with some more tape to use to help lubricate the inside of the threads. And those were the two big custom tools we kind of built for that next spacewalk. And the crew was able to go out there, clean the bolt stanchion up, and we got that box installed. So that was definitely a cool moment to be walking around the control center as an intern with a bag of CVS toothbrushes to go bring to the conference room to show everybody what we were working on.
What was the reaction from the astronauts when you're saying, okay, I think we have a fix in mind. Now first get a toothbrush. You know, yeah. What's that conversation like?
It was one of those, all right, well, I guess if it works, it works. And,
wow. So, I mean, that had to be a pretty cool feeling when it did work and, you know, you got the results you were looking for.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I think it was definitely one of those, well, that was awesome. Like we all got to be a part of this thing that we totally didn't expect to happen, but, and probably didn't anticipate what the solutions would be, but here we are.
Wow. That is cool. It has to be kind of a feeling going to work. I mean, I don't know if I would describe it as a feeling like you can't wait to get to work, but it has to feel pretty rewarding to do what you're doing.
Yeah, and that I kind of alluded to it earlier, right? It can get easy. I mean, at the end of the day, we're still a government institution, right? So there's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of places where you can get mired in the muck of bureaucracy and of waiting on things to get done and waiting to process changes and waiting for your next mission. But at the same time, right, you walk into the control center, you look up at the board and you realize that we've had humans in space for 20 years consecutively, and we've got HD views of the Earth as we take 16 laps around it a day. Is a pretty extraordinary thing that we've been able to do, and that I get to come in every day and be a part of that.
It really is powerful. And you know, if there were a multiple choice test on how many years we've had people in space consecutively, I'm not even sure I would have gotten that right. That 20 year number, just in my lifetime, just as somebody who appreciates this sort of thing, that really snuck up on me.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
And I'll give you another fun fact there. If you come down here and you look at the control center, there's a flag that flies on top of the control center, an American flag, and that flag only flies when there's an American in space. So my entire time working here, we've had a flag up on that pole.
Wow.
That is really cool.
That's really powerful stuff. Ronak, because we're getting kind of close to the end here, but I'm just wondering, is there anything that you wish the sort of general public at large knew or understood or appreciated about ISS or even just our ongoing efforts in space, whether it's this ISS or heading back to the moon or heading to Mars? Is there one thing that you think that people, you know, maybe aren't aware of that you really wish they were?
Yeah, I think just at a big picture, right? It's really an extraordinary time to be a part of human spaceflight, and you hear stories and to a certain extent, right, that the ISS is getting old. So at some point we're going to have to retire it, but we're really at the precipice of opening all these other avenues up, and not just NASA and the US government, right, but working with international and commercial partners to help open the space up that has really just been governmental out to commercial industries and putting these commercial space stations in low Earth orbit and opening that bandwidth to the folks who can spend money on things that may not necessarily get you a return on investment immediately, like NASA, to go generate a extended and continuing presence around the moon and on the moon, and then use those learnings to go to Mars, right? If you look at the past 10 years of human spaceflight, we've had extraordinary growth in the commercial sector. And I think what you're going to see over the next 10 years is going to be really similar of this exponential change in what we're able to do as humans, not just in low Earth orbit, but beyond.
Oh, that is well said. I love the space program. I love everything that it does from a standpoint of exploration, but also, you know, I think it's just really important. Young people have something to look forward to achieve. I mean, there's a lot of young people in school who their dream is to go work at NASA. And I think that's an avenue that NASA, it's a byproduct, right? I mean, of course, space exploration is number one, but there's something to be said for people having something to dream and go after. And NASA is certainly one of those places you dream of going.
Yeah, it's definitely something I dreamed of doing. And that's why we're really happy to come on shows like this and come out to the museum and meet folks and talk to folks. And so they can see people that do it, right? And know that it's an option and it's real. It's not just something you read about.
Yeah. If you were to meet a young person, you know, maybe they're in grade school, middle school, or even in early high school, I suppose, and they said, you know what, my dream is very much like yours, and, you know, I would love to end up, you know, working at NASA and being involved in these missions. What advice do you have for them?
I think first and foremost is just go find what you're passionate in and go do it, right? It sometimes that will mean hard work that will never go recognized. Sometimes that will mean leading a project that you're the face named leader of. But as long as you're enjoying what you're doing and it's something you're passionate about, that will come out. And it will come out when you interview for jobs. It will come out when you talk to folks about what you do. And if you're not excited about something and you're not passionate about it, then you got to go think about what you actually want to do. So that's the biggest thing, right? If you keep working at something like that you're passionate about, that good things will happen.
So probably my last question, I saved it on purpose. It's one that I used at Theater in the Woods this year and we had a blast with, but I've got to ask you, what is your favorite space themed TV show, series, movie? Do you have a favorite?
Ooh.
Yeah. This got really heated at Theater in the Woods this year.
That's hard.
Like For All Mankind up there. I don't know if you've watched that.
Apology. I actually just started that, so no spoilers.
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good.
Yeah, the biggest spoiler happens like in the first few minutes, the first episode. Yeah. After that, you're okay, just off.
That far
you're then, off so. And running.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think just for what I'll say is that the accuracy of how he was able to portray what I think would actually happen here. I'll say The Martian. I think that outside of the graphics, if you watch the movie, the way that Andy Weir, the author, describes Johnson Space Center and how a lot of those interactions in that book go, it felt very real to me. So that is what I'd give you. I also, this is kind of a non sequitur, but I'm a big fan of The West Wing, and I'd love if we got a Aaron Sorkin-esque version of the MCC where you got people walking and talking around the corridors, and I think that would make a great show.
Some poor cameraman is just, you know, getting wheeled backward for hours at a time, trying to keep things on track. So,
oh, I love it. I love it. So, again, thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for coming out and being our speaker at Space Day. Which is, as we're recording, that's this upcoming weekend. Really, it's going to be an honor to have you here. I know there's a lot of young people excited to meet you. And again, I think it's important that you're there representing something that a lot of us dream about, and you're here to say, you know, yeah, it's real and I work there and this is what we do. And just wanted to say thank you for doing all that.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I'm happy to join you today and looking forward to coming up north here, over the weekend. And, I'm just, upset it's not in July and I could see all the planes coming in, but I guess that'll be the subsequent trip.
Well, that's it. We'll work on getting you here for the big show. For those, and Ronak, thank you again for being here. For those listening, we appreciate you being here. Your comments and feedback are always appreciated. If you have someone you'd like to see us get on the Green Dot, let us know. You know, always happy to try to hunt down someone you think might be interesting. And again, thank you for your support. Did want to call out just a quick shout out to Randy and Barb. These are actually two listeners from the Green Dot who listened to the Green Dot faithfully and actually got outside their comfort zone and became volunteers at AirVenture this year. So thank you guys not only for listening, but thanks for coming out and volunteering too. So we
you're here.
Yeah, it's really cool to see you guys here. And so with that, just want to say again, thank you for your support. We'll be back with another episode very soon, and we will catch you then when we're cleared to land on the Green Dot.